We are listener supported. One Radio Network.
Figure out how to drive this thing, we'll be fine. Very pleasant good morning to you. And this is Patrick Timpone. And it's the real world of money. The real world of money. We do it the first Wednesday of every month. And the star of the show is Fred Jastrzewski. Fred is used to be a co-conspirator with... with Andrew Goss. He was a co-conspirator with Andrew Goss. And Andrew... left the playing field long before he was supposed to leave the playing field, Fred. I mean, have you talked to him lately, like in the other realms, and see how he's doing? I've been channeling him lately. I think he's doing good. Hi, Fred. Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you today?
I'm good, sir. How's it feel to be a former co-conspirator with Andrew Goss? You're okay with that, right?
Oh, I couldn't be more proud.
Yeah, couldn't be. You worked with Andrew for how many years?
It's about 36 years, I think.
Wow.
Give or take a couple of months. Yeah, we started as puppies together.
Yeah.
We both entered the coin business, and just by coincidence or fate, whatever you want to call it, started to work at the same coin company about 2 weeks apart.
Is that right? That's... And then fate brought you together, right? The fickle finger of fate, as they used to say.
Yeah.
And Andrew Goss, a currency historian, who we've got a whole plethora of shows on our website. He and I go back, I guess, early 90s when I saw him on TV. And so if you'd like to look, hear some of his old shows, we have, I guess, Fred, we have about 12 years of shows with Andrew, right? 12 or 13 years.
That's fantastic.
And I listened to some of them. You know, I'm working on the screenplay, which he inspired. And I was listening to one last night from 2012. And I mean, just such great stuff. I mean, it's like, it's a PhD in economics, isn't it? Or the monetary system, the way this stuff he knew.
You know, when I think about it, when we both first started at this in our early 20s, you know, we knew nothing. We really knew nothing. We knew what most people got in terms of an education, basically from high school and college. And, you know, I studied economics in college. And we probably, within the first 6 months, began to realize there was so much more information that we'd never come across before. And it began a process of learning. And Andy dug into it, like, voraciously. And we just started on this, you know, process of accumulating information and coming up with things that challenged what we knew, and just going back and forth between, you know, what we thought we knew versus what turned out to be, you know, more of the truth. And the disparity between the two was kind of shocking initially, and, you know, caught me so much by surprise. And then as we ventured forward, we just presumed, because we were young and stupid, you know, we figured, well, there must be older, intelligent people out there who know this. And as we continued to learn, somebody should know. And it just turned out that, especially that should have known, like Congress people, didn't really seem to have a grasp on the essential matters of money that, you know, we found to be so important. And as we began to relate it initially just to the fact that this was our new career in this coin business, it just began to unravel that proverbial onion layer after onion layer, and it continued. And Andy never gave up the gathering of information.
Never
he
did.
Never stopped. And he kept digging. And, you know, he'd grab onto something and then just have to drill down to it until he finally got down to the bottom. And then it's like, okay, we're done there. We move on. And then there would be the peripheral stuff that you find, you know, when you're studying something, a name comes up or something is referenced, and well, then we jump into that and continue down that trail. And it began to unravel one of the most amazing information trails, you know, I've ever experienced. I think the only thing in my lifetime that has ever been larger than the monetary system is when I started studying, you know, astrophysics. I mean, other than that, I don't think there's anything bigger than the game of money. And it is an interesting interesting game.
Fred Jastrzebski.
You talk about Andy as a conspirator.
Yeah.
Anti-Fed people. You
Anti-Fed
know?
People. Fred Jastrzebski is our guest, and Fred is now co-conspirator, because he has a couple of people that he works with on uscoincapital.com. It's a great website, great company that we'll tell you about this morning, uscoincapital.com, and they deal in real American money, right, Fred? Just coins that are from the mint. You all don't do bullion. It's all money that is actually spendable, but you wouldn't do it. I mean, you wouldn't take a St. Gaudens $20 gold coin. I guess you could, but you wouldn't want to do that because they're worth a couple thousand dollars.
Well, you wouldn't, of course, you know, the $20 St. Gaudens gold coin. Many people have asked as novices, does a $20 gold coin cost $20? Or why does a $20 gold coin cost $20? Which is, you know, an interesting question. It seems obvious at some points, but if you think about it, at one point, it was $20. You know, up through 1933, the last time we minted $20 gold coins in the United States, they were identical to the 20 paper dollar note that we floated around. And over time, we have separated the two. One, because that $20 gold coin contains an ounce of gold. And gold itself, as of right now, $1,947 for an ounce of gold.
Wow.
So a $20 gold coin carries that weight of gold, plus the fact that as a American legal currency coin, they can't any more of them and stopped producing them back in 1933. But this was the legal currency of the United States. This was the intended monetary system the founding fathers left for us as a nation to protect us against unscrupulous politicians or outside influences from interfering with the public's ability to earn a dollar, save a dollar over time, spend it later on, and still retain the same purchasing power. It was a brilliant system, pretty simple and straightforward. It wasn't until years later that paper money began to be issued. And at that time, all of the paper money was backed 100% by these types of gold and silver coins that the U.S. Mint produced.
100%.
So that the public could exchange their discretion.
And you could actually go into a bank, right, and say, here's a $20 bill or whatever, and they would give you a gold coin per its value. Right?
Sure. You know, back in the early days of the early part of our republic, there was an awful lot of confidence building that needed to take place. We needed to solidify the concept of what our government was going to be like, what kind of established monetary policies we were going to have. And in order to create confidence, I don't think many people in those days would have merely accepted the idea that a government would print a paper note that wasn't backed by something.
Really?
And that we would take that for our effort, labor, and work. It seemed unacceptable. So we needed a standard by which we could justify the value of our currency. And we continue to have a gold-backed dollar all the way from the 1790s till 1933 it survived. And silver sustained a backing to the U.S. dollar until the days of Richard Nixon in 1971. So in my lifetime, you know, I watched this change occur from having a metal-backed dollar, paper note, to having nothing backing it. And of course, we've seen the onslaught of what has occurred since that standard has been removed. I think it harkens back to the concerns that the founding fathers had initially of why we should have a gold and silver standard in the first place.
Because they kind of knew, because they were politicians themselves, Fred, that they're just going to print more dollars than they have gold if you don't do that, and then things get carried away, and the value, then the dollar goes down because of that's true in freight.
Naturally.
Right?
Right. And I think their concern wasn't so much inflation of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Their concern was influence. Their concern was bankers, for example, influencing the way the monetary system would work, or politicians interfering with the way the monetary system would work. And they were smart enough to know they couldn't foresee what might occur in the future, but also were, concerned enough about men, quote unquote, as a whole, suggesting that we always need to be prepared to curtail the tendencies of men to abuse privilege. And influence could certainly be a big problem for a public if someone is changing the value of their money. So what they tried to devise, without being able to foresee what might happen in the future, was some method of protection to the public. And their way of doing that was to say, all the money that we utilize is intrinsically made of a valuable metal that everybody already recognizes as valuable. It staves off a whole slew of potential problems.
Yeah.
And again, I think the current economy we're in is purely evidence that they were right.
Which we're going to talk about this morning. Fred, I hear a woman's voice somewhere in the background, like a newscast or something. Do you have something on?
Oh, sorry. We'll just turn down the old CNBC in the background.
We still got
How's
it.
How's that?
We still got it.
Really?
Very low.
Hold on. There we go.
Ah, boy. Okay, you know, I got these little thing here. I hear it all, you know. So if you'd like to be on the show, triple eight years of radio, 888-663-6386. Come on in, join us. Question: we have a lot to kick around. We'll do past, present, future in the monetary game with Fred this morning for a little while. A little bit later on, Dr. William Wong is going to be here, and we're going to talk a bit about potential issues coming up in the next few months for your health, your wealth and your well-being, protection, food, those kind of things. You know, no fear porn, but just in the realm of preparing for the worst and hoping for the best, which we recommend we do. And he's an interesting fellow, so he's going to be here a little bit later on. Again, if you'd like to do the telephone thing with Fred this morning and Dr. Wong, it is 888-663-6386. You talked about the essential matters of money. For newbies and new people joining us, and always a good refresher for all of us, what are the essentials of money that we as consumers or users of Federal Reserve notes, because that's all we got, right? At this point, what metrics are the essential that we should understand?
Well, I think in the modern era, we of course no longer have this gold or silver standard that we were given by our forefathers. So we are left now with what they refer to as a fiat system. It's a expression used to refer to money that's unbacked. And the fundamental issue then for the current world and people in the current economy is, how do we define the value of our dollar? So most people don't give this much thought. They don't look at their money and try to ascertain what value it has. They make that determination based upon their purchases. So they go out into the world and they make acquisitions with the money that they have. And if they notice that they have to spend more of these dollars, paper notes, to buy the same goods and services, they begin to get that perception that the value of the money is changing. The problem that we're in the modern era is that we have begun to accelerate the rate at which we are creating unbacked paper money due to a number of things. Most importantly, the fact that the U.S. government has been running deficits. So as politicians tend to do, the government has been spending progressively more and more money that it does not bring in from its revenue resources, tax payments, sales of securities and bonds and things of that nature. And it leaves us with deficits each and every year. And those deficits are growing, and they're growing substantially. And they're growing so large that the Fed has been forced to create additional money to make up for shortfalls. And then we began to grow this deficit to such a large degree that it began requiring the government and the Federal Reserve to begin to manipulate entire markets and to begin to justify the fact that it had huge, massive debt holes that it knew it couldn't compensate for directly. So, for example, we have funds within the U.S. government. Social Security is probably the best and most well-known. Mm-hmm. It's a trust fund in the sense that money has been contributed by working Americans for decades, since the 1920s. And the concept was is that we would contribute a small portion of our wage into a fund so that we would have protection at our retirement in case we weren't able to save money and the government could subsidize our retirement plans. And this money that we contributed by our labor was supposed to be held by the government in trust. In other words, legally not spent for any other purpose, simply held for this particular fund. Unfortunately, the government began to run up such large deficits because it couldn't constrain its ability to spend more money than it took in. And since it didn't have to restrain itself based on any gold or silver standard, it could print its way out of any problem. It turns out that we blew through trillions of in this Social Security fund. It now sits bankrupt and empty.
Literally, still have a requirement. It's literally empty, right, Fred? It's just non-marketable securities, just IOUs, not even treasury bonds, correct?
Not even treasury bonds.
Just IOUs.
The first step of the withdrawal of money from the fund was to use the actual money that was in the fund. Once we had done that, the government stepped in and said, okay, we technically need to maintain or sustain an idea that there is some capital in this fund. What we're going to do is to put treasury securities and fill the Social Security Trust Fund with these government IOUs. These are government securities. And the thought process was most people in the world of Wall Street, the world of banking, would deem a government security about as secure as it gets. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't far different from actually having the money, because in theory, you could cash in any of these government securities and immediately turn them right back into the cash that they represented. But over time, we couldn't even sustain that. So by the 1980s and 1990s, we began to strip the treasury securities from the fund and began to replace them with literal IOUs written by the Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin. And he literally said, I'm taking all of these government guaranteed treasury securities, pulling them from the trust fund, and I'm going to scribble on a piece of paper, I owe you $4 trillion, and that is now going to be the only thing that resides in Social Security. And it's a promise that some point in the future, hopefully the government would have sufficient additional money that it could then replace the IOUs with either these treasury securities or the actual cash required.
So
neither of which have ever come.
Is it four? I thought it was more like $3 trillion, but is it four? I'll have to look at the...
It's 3+. Whatever. I think we're at the 3.5.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize. So
yeah, not quite.
So when we hear people talk about the trust fund's going to run on 2030 and all of this stuff, what they're really talking about is, are they just talking about how much is coming in and going out and this mythical trust fund will go out of balance at that point, 2030 or 35 or something like
yes.
that, right?
Well, as I said before, what happened is the problem has gotten so out of control that they've started to gimmick the game. So the first gimmick was, of course, this replacement with these IOUs. Mm-hmm. So what happens in the current world now? We're still sending out checks every week to Social Security recipients. Where's the money coming from? The reality is we're printing it as we need it. And in doing the math on the Social Security Fund, they began to look at about 10 or 15 years ago, the movement of the age of Americans, they're calling it the graying of America, so it's shifting toward more retired people than working people, which is creating a mathematical problem for this trust fund. Initially, there were about 15 people contributing for every one person who was withdrawing from the fund. Mm-hmm. We began to get close to the crossover point where we were having an equal number of people contributing to the number of people withdrawing. And now we've crossed over where we now have more people pulling out money than are contributing. So even if there was actual money in the fund, if you think about it, any place where you have more people pulling out then are contributing, you're going to draw down that fund until eventually it'll be at zero. But so the math that they're referring to by 2023 is simply the idea that if we believe that there's money in the fund, even that will be gone by 2023.
Do we know the number? I've been trying to find out, and I've got some close idea of how much is actually coming out of taxes and being borrowed to keep it all going. Is it in the $200 billion range, or do we know that number for sure?
Just specifically for Social Security?
Yeah, just specifically for Social Security, Medicare.
No, I don't know what that number is.
We don't know. We're short, though. Right.
It's got to be large. Yes. I mean, we're already right now, as of 2020, we are printing every check from a checkbook with nothing in it. We are creating the money, literally, to make good on the payments that we promised the general public. And this is why politicians find themselves in a very difficult position. You know, most people with intelligence can understand that you can't sustain an account if more people are withdrawing than are contributing. So how do you deal with that? You can either say to those people that are due money, sorry, we're going to default on our promise and obligation and not pay you, which would be politically suicidal. Or you can try to reduce the payments that people are getting to some degree and try to get the public to accept that, which again, very difficult politically. And the politicians don't want to touch the subject, because effectively there's really no solution to it except to print more money, and wants to admit that we're just merely printing money to make good obligations. It's political third rail, as they call it.
And when you say printing money, it's important to be clear that we've been taught, you and Andy, that we, the government, do not print the money. The Federal Reserve Bank does, and we borrow it from them. And that's a key thing that you guys tried to get out there. How long ago did you talk about that idea? What are we doing? Borrowing this money from a private bank, right?
Right. Now, the mechanism of which we print money, it can come in two forms, if you think about it. The U.S. Treasury could certainly print its own money. We've done this before in history. They were referred to as United States notes, and they came out at various times in American history. The most recent ones, 1963, just before John Kennedy's assassination, we were creating United States notes. So the Treasury could directly issue money into the economy. It still creates a debt situation. But instead of doing that, in 1914, Congress was convinced by a coalition of very smart bankers who spent a number of years researching and studying the history of banking in Europe, going back to the Bank of England in 1694, and they concluded that they could gain control over the monetary issue of currency in the United States by creating a central bank that would have the sub job of creating the money for the government. There was really no reason to create a central bank to do that. The Treasury had the legal authority and technical ability to produce the money, but we were convinced that government was not doing a sufficient job of covering the problems with money that we had experienced in money panics currently, like, for example, COVID as a financial crisis. We've had these kinds of crises before in American history. Many of them have occurred. One of the most outrageous ones was the panic of 1907, which eventually led to a cry from the public to resolve these massive swings in the economy and the value of money. And the solution that was offered was this Federal Reserve system. It was going to stabilize the economy by taking out of the hands of government and putting in the hands of private bankers the mechanism of issuing and controlling money.
And many people argue that the 07 panic was a controlled thing too, to help take them to the 1913.
Yes, you could easily draw that argument out.
Sure. But we don't.
At that time in American history, there were a number of things that were happening. So you had consolidations of a number of major industries in the United States occurring. So where single powers were beginning to control entire industries. So for example, Vanderbilt took control over the railroad industry. John D. Rockefeller took control over the oil industry. Andrew Carnegie took over the control of the steel industry. And J.P. Morgan did the same thing when it came to banking. He began to consolidate the banking world into smaller and smaller hands with more and more power, and effectively used that leverage to create a monetary panic that was so vast that the public screamed for a solution. You and I have talked about this Hegelian dialect. This was a perfect example. You create a problem, then you come and offer a solution. And of course, all the public knows is they're tired of the volatility.
Sure.
And they want stability. And if you're offering them a solution, they're gonna go for it. So Congress accepted the idea of this central bank.
I wonder, do you know by what authority did JFK, and I think, was it about 3 million silver certificates or 3 or 4 million? I'm not sure of that number. I used to know it. And I think he did back it by the silver in the treasury, JFK's idea. Do we know what...
Dollar silver certificates.
I'm sorry?
Yes, the $1 silver certificates.
Well, do we know by what authority JFK did that? Because doesn't the Constitution say you can't emit bills of credit? Didn't they take that out of the Constitution?
Well, I think the authority that JFK rested on was merely an executive order.
Hmm.
So he utilized an executive order to say he had a hard problem with the idea of having to borrow money from bankers, loaning it to government, and then paying interest on our money. So, he resisted, but unfortunately also recognized the reality was that he didn't have a lot of leverage. The system was in place. And, you know, as powerful as a president is, and I've made this argument, if you will, many, many times, presidents come and go. You know, we have elections and people have said, oh, this election is critical and this election is critical. And after this, things will change.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the presidents, they come and they go and the Federal Reserve still remains in power.
Yeah.
So JFK utilized an executive order to try to subvert. He wanted to finance things like the Peace Corps,
yes,
his space program. And he didn't want to have to borrow money to put extra debt on the back of the American public. And he said, well, instead of borrowing money from the Federal Reserve, why don't we just simply have Congress create this capital and distribute it into the economy? And that's what he did, although he had a limited ability under the executive orders on how much he could create this way. He began to push back against the idea of the central banks. Of course, he didn't survive very long after that, so we never know how far that would have gone, but there were a limited number of the silver certificates and U.S. notes issued in that era.
And
it was from an executive order.
But did he, at that time in 63, before he was assassinated, did he actually consult with Congress to do this, or did he just, boom, boom, do we know? Did he just do the EO? Do we know?
You know, I think he faced the same problem we face now. If you want to look at the number of congressmen, and the number of them that really fundamentally understand the nature of how money works or a central bank's actual role. You know, if you think about it, most of the major bodies within government gain their power from the Constitution. So the Supreme Court, for example, derives its power directly from the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Reserve's power is a little bit less, you know, secure. It's a little more tentative. And it creates windows of opportunity, but again, they are so powerful and so well entrenched that resistance, as the old line goes, resistance is futile.
Resistance is futile. Fred Jaschewski is where. Fred, you know, let's get to present day and talk about something that I want to get your take on. I mean, the blogosphere, as you know, they're, in my opinion, their currency really is clicks, right, and follows, and that's how they make their living,
sure,
right? So there's a lot of bloggy guys out there on all platforms, from Bloomberg, everywhere, you know, left, right, center,
right,
libertarian, that are really talking up the idea of some kind of a reboot, reset. I don't know. You use your term, you know, that something's going to happen.
I've heard it.
Yeah, you've heard it. Something's going to happen to kind of right this ship, and because we got too much debt and all this stuff. Do you think anything big, in your opinion, studying this for your whole life, really, is going to happen to get rid of debt, debt jubilee, some kind of a currency reset? Do you see anything that you could put your arms around and say, yeah, this may happen?
You want a short answer?
Well, no. Okay. I thought you were going to say that because you're a realist. I mean, you are a realist with this, aren't you, Fred?
I am. So, this is a difficult subject because conceptually, the idea that we need to revisit the thought of maybe somehow reverting back to a gold standard
or whatever,
a Federal Reserve system that would have a gold-backed dollar again, or this reset, as they're referring it, right. to it. You know, it reminds me of back around 2011 to 2012, rumors were beginning to circulate that in Iraq, the dinar was going to be reset.
Right.
And it was going to be a new exchange rate for the dinar, and it was going to be 10 or 100 times more valuable than it was.
It's still going on, that idea, by the way. It's just so you know. There's still...
Is that right?
Oh, there's still millions of people that believe that the dinar is going to move up in value.
Okay. Well, they've been waiting since 2011 or 2012.
Probably, yeah.
Under the same pretense.
Right.
That, the finance minister had made a comment at a G8 meeting and it spread like wildfire, and then everybody began to speculate. Now, you couldn't buy Iraqi dinar outside of Iraq, but a few people figured out how to get some in the United States, and then a few companies sprung up to sell them to people, and people were speculating. And I mean, they took in incredible amounts of money, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in speculative capital. And of course, it never happened, because there's no government on earth that is going to reset their currency and make it more valuable. It just seemed unreal. I find that the arguments and conversations about the current world of a Fed reset or reestablishing a gold standard, it's got the same flaw. It's a great concept, and you can understand why people would derive that thought process with the monstrous amount of debt. We carry $28 trillion roughly in debt,
yes,
as a country. Plus, right? We have all the other obligations we don't like to count. So even if we accept the $28 trillion number, the United States entered it joined a new club this year.
What's that?
We joined the club of Italy and Greece, becoming now one of the first countries on earth to ever spend as much money in a year as the entire output of the nation's production.
So
we've now achieved this level for the first time.
So the output...
our deficit this year is going to be...
Yeah, so output is what?
More than the entire GDP.
Output is a GDP, gross domestic product, right? That's everything that we sell. I mean, all
everything.
And how much is that each year?
Well, this year it's going to be about $3.6 trillion. And we're going to spend $3.7 trillion.
Oh, you mean you're talking about the budget? No, wait a minute. But isn't our GDP like $20 trillion? No?
The total GDP is about $20 trillion, so we are going to end up with more debt than the entire output of our nation. But what we're going to produce in terms of deficits this year is going to be equal to all of the production of the country. It's incredible. So only a few other nations have ever achieved this level, and I believe it was... just want to refer to this for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Italy, Greece... and now the United States. So we've entered an interesting club here.
So I'm sorry.
Japan was the other one.
I'm sorry. I'm still a little bit confused, but, I'm Italian, so I stay that way. So work with me here. So let's see. The total GDP for 1 year, isn't it in the $17 trillion range? Or do I have the right number?
Yeah.
Okay.
The total debt held by the public.
Total debt held by the public is $28 trillion or so, right?
And that's going to be, yes, and we're going to exceed that level in debt for the first time. So we are crossing levels now where our accumulated debt is now greater than the GDP. So we are deficit spending an ever-increasing amount So much so. Well, let's look at it this way. Think about it as an individual. Let's say an individual earns $100,000 a year, and that individual already owes $1 million in debt. And last year, that individual spent another $30,000 it didn't take in. And this year, that individual spends $100,000 more in debt. In other words, every dollar that individual earns for the whole year is required just to pay the debt. And that's before paying any of the, you know, normal living expenses, right. You know, housing and normal bills and things of that nature. So the point is, we are clearly accelerating by dramatic margins the rate at which we are accumulating debt. And it's getting to a considerable point to where, you know, we are now entering into an unusual club of countries that have gotten so far in debt that it becomes almost mathematically difficult to understand how we would ever pay our way out of it.
Ever.
In other words, it's hard to imagine even growing our way out of it.
President Obama was criticized because I think he added about $10 trillion on to debt, right, in his 8 years. But President Trump is actually exceeding those numbers, right? I mean, not blaming him particularly, right?
Each president successfully has spent more money than every president before him by the time they're done. We have tripled the deficit spending just in the past 3 years.
Triple.
So where we were spending $800 to $900 billion a year, we're now at 3.7. The Office of Management and Budget estimated that going forward from here on in, mm-hmm. that we would, on an average, deficit spend about $2 trillion a year.
A year.
That's just going to be the norm going forward every year.
So is it
$2 trillion?
How did we get so more upside down than 10 years ago? Where's all that money going? I mean, we haven't hired that. Are we spending more on defense or hired more people? Where's all that money going?
It has gone to finance fiscal crises that have continued to occur.
Crises.
Because we are manipulating the economy. And as we manipulate the economy, the game gets larger and larger, and the fraud is bigger and bigger. So when a problem balloons and explodes and bubbles and bursts, these problems become so large that they require infusions of massive amounts of capital.
Give us an example.
So we can follow the trail.
Give us an example,
sure.
of a big one that are coming up the last 2 or 3.
2008.
Okay.
Let's start with 2008. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the largest in American history by far. It was such a large financial crisis. The implosion of the economy was imminent. It required a massive infusion of capital. It required a massive recalculation of how we would address the debt issues. It required new, we'll call them tricks by the central bank, the Federal Reserve, to try to address all the debts that have been created and to stave off what would have been an implosion of the entire U.S. economy.
Hmm.
So the 2008 financial crisis was so vast, it created debt that would take years and years and years to unwind. And the Federal Reserve spent so much money solving that problem in 2008. It wasn't even until 2011 it began to try to unwind some of that debt that it acquired. And the Fed's solution in 2008 was to buy up a lot of bad debt from a number of institutions across the United States, move all that debt onto its own balance sheets to alleviate the debt load from the banking institutions and the financial institutions and leave the problem on the Fed's balance sheet. And in 2011, when the Fed tried to unwind it for the first time, it created so much of a financial hiccup because it forced a big problem, which was if the Fed was trying to sell debt obligations into the economy instead of being a buyer of debt from the U.S. government, the U.S. government still needed to raise its own capital. There was simply too much supply of debt coming into the market, and it created liquidity problems. And that was just from 2008. 2012, we experienced more financial upset, and COVID has been even bigger.
Huge.
Because it required the infusion of so much capital that the debt has exploded. The Federal Reserve didn't want to repeat the 2008 fiscal crisis, which was a liquidity issue. It was literally a lack of money available. So it went overboard and it went on steroids and said, well, we're going to pump money into the economy this time. So when COVID broke out, not only did the Fed do what it had done in 2008, which was buy up things like mortgage-backed securities and treasury obligations, but it also began to infuse capital directly into the economy. And it crossed the line for the first time and did things it had never done before. It began to buy debt obligations from private corporations. It began to buy ETFs. The plunge protection team stepped in quite heavily. The Federal Reserve began to apply itself into providing liquidity into areas that it cannot legally do unless it's in a state of emergency. So it utilized this small provision in the Federal Reserve's charter, 13.3, which is an emergency case scenario, that affords it a more expanded opportunity to buy more kinds of debt obligations. So what we've done in the past 6 or 8 months is three times larger than what we did in all of 2008.
Wow.
We've already expanded way more quickly than what we did in 2008.
Now,
that's where all this money is going.
I'm looking at the Fed's balance sheet as we speak here. It's called the H41 release, and you can Google that or DuckDuckGo it, and just go to the latest one, which is September 2nd. New one will be out probably in a couple of days, and they're right at $7 trillion, Fred, on their balance sheet. But there's been more money put out there that we've heard, but it's not on the balance sheet, right? So is that some of the stuff that went through BlackRock and other things to get money out there that doesn't show up on the Fed's balance sheet?
Absolutely. So the Fed was very smart. Not only did it add to its own balance sheet, and again, from 2008, it learned a very valuable lesson. The $4+ trillion that it ended up with on its balance sheet after that crisis was so hard to unwind that in this crisis, it decided to spread the risk around. So it began to utilize systems BlackRock to be able to step in and make purchases for them indirectly with their backing and with the backing of the U.S. Treasury. So the Congress actually backstopped BlackRock's purchases of debt instruments up to a certain point so that, again, it would add the legitimacy to it. But the Fed was smart enough to sort of try to spread the risk around. It was a little concerned that if people saw how big its balance sheet was getting, that
people
would lose
confidence. So how is it possible, one of Andy's book is Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. I guess it's possible, Fred Dyshevsky. How is it possible that the New York Fed can create dollars on a computer, do some magic through BlackRock to, you know, get stuff out there and not be on its balance sheet? How do they get away with that?
Well, again, they're gimmicking the whole game.
It's just
they continue to come up with more ways
to
of
do
subverting the reality, right? So if you know, this reminds me of the fable, The Emperor Has No Clothes. If we're going to sit there and say, well, I think the gown he's wearing is gold. No, I think it's blue. No, I think it's gray. And we're going to sit there and split the hair of what color are we seeing? You know, we need that young child to stand there and say, excuse me, he's butt naked. So if we're going to ignore the reality that we're simply creating money to finance our problems, we can come up with all sorts of interesting ways to manage the appearance that this has some legitimacy and create an environment where we can pretend, you know, that we have control over what's happening. A lot of people are questioning whether the Fed even has a mechanism to figure out how to unwind what it's doing. Even Chairman Powell has alluded to the idea that they don't really know how they're going to deal with what they're doing now. But by default, they're so concerned that you and I and everyone has money and that we don't have an economy that implodes, that they're willing to forgo the concern of how to address the problem down the road for the sake of solving it in the current term.
And tell us why, you used the term unwind the balance sheet. Talk to us like we're a young child or a golden retriever so we understand. What does that mean? So the Fed creates money, the New York Fed, they buy stuff, you know, they buy treasuries and BlackRock and they do their magic to get liquidity out there so we don't storm the White House with pitchforks, right? So What does that mean, unwind? What does that mean, unwind? Why do they got to do something with it? Is it just loss of confidence, as you've said before, if they get too much on their front?
Well, it's a big part of it. So it's not as if the Fed really has a limit on how much it can add to its balance sheet.
Yeah,
technically speaking, since it can create whatever amount of money it wants,
right,
there's nothing to stop it from just loading up its balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
The problem becomes that if the Fed is the owner of last resort of all of the debt, the appearance starts to become fairly clear that the economy is not self-sustaining anymore. That the only reason we're surviving is because we have this intervening party that is manipulating the economy and effectively taking off all of the debts that we're acquiring and shifting them over to its own debt instrument, its own debt balance sheet. But at some point, the Fed is required to settle its books. It has to unwind all of the debt that it has on its balance sheet. Now, it can take time to do that, but the problem becomes a matter of volume. At some point, they have so much in the way of debt on their balance sheet that there isn't even a mechanism to unwind that volume. And again, this was an example of what happened in 2011. Just the amount that they'd acquired from 2008 became so problematic when they tried to unwind it in 2011, they almost created another financial crisis. They've now subsequently not only added to that volume, but it's up now to, where are we,
seven and a half,
almost 8 trillion?
No, on the balance sheet says seven.
Seven. I guarantee it's a little bit more than that. But
yeah,
so let's say it's seven plus trillion dollars. They couldn't unwind 3.5 trillion in 2011. They moved about 400 billion back into the economy, and that was enough to pretty much throw a monkey wrench in the works and almost again crack the economy. So how would they possibly unwind 7 trillion?
By unwind, do you mean
more?
They have 7 trillion of paper that they would have to go out to the marketplace, and paper that they bought with new dollars that they created, and sell them? Couldn't they sell them for pennies on the dollar? Couldn't they sell them for pennies on the dollar?
Well, sure. And again, if they did that, we have the same fundamental problem, which is that we're cheating the system.
I see. Wow.
So the Fed pays you as a banker 100 cents on the dollar, and then it only sells the debt obligation for 10 cents on the dollar. Well, guess who gets to make up the gap?
Who?
It's you and I and all the taxpayers.
Well, why do we get to make up the gap? That's their balance sheet, not ours. How do we get back in there?
Welcome to the world of banking. So we are on the hook as a country. You know, the $28 trillion that the government owes, effectively that means we, the taxpayers.
Right.
This is our debt.
Right.
The problem, as I see it, is that the Fed has a need to accelerate the rate at which it's creating money. It needs to increase the rate at which it produces paper money now, because the government is spending more than ever before, and the Fed has this massive balance sheet, and we still need to stimulate the economy. You do all those things simultaneously, we are flooding the streets with money at a rate no one's ever seen. This is completely unprecedented. The volume is so massive. And I know we throw these terms around, you know, trillions, as if we have a grasp. But
right.
I mean, these are vast numbers. They're monstrously large.
Well, why? How?
And it's going to be decades.
Why is it that Starbucks coffee doesn't cost $10 instead of $5 or whatever? If there's so much money out there chasing after that coffee?
It will.
You
know, part of the reason why it hasn't happened yet is because the economy is moving extremely slow.
Okay.
So we're not getting a tremendous amount of money
velocity
through the system with such a stagnant economy. The velocity is very, very low.
Yes.
If the economy begins to pick up speed, you're going to begin to see that accelerated rate at which prices increase. And I assure you, the next generation, you know, the $20 or $30 cup of Starbucks is going to be just as normal as the $4.50 one that we see today. And it'll be perfectly normal to that generation. They won't understand, you know, why we even raise an eyebrow at it.
Fred Duszewski, The Real World of Money, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Give your company a little plug here. If you go to USCoinCapital.com, why on earth would somebody purchase, let's say, a $20 St. Gaudens for a couple grand, $1,000, well, there's an ounce of gold in a St. Gaudens, right? Gold's almost 2,000.
Sure.
So,
well, you know, it's a pretty straightforward concept.
Yeah,
so
talk us through that a little
the
bit.
The way that we used to have our system was we have this, as we had talked about, this gold or silver-backed dollar, right? So having that prevented not only the ability to deficit spend and gimmick the markets the way we are now and would prevent the Fed from doing all these crazy actions and prevent the government from writing checks to the public for money it doesn't have, but what it would do was to provide the general populace with the ability to earn a dollar that would also stay the same in its value. In other words, its buying power over time. And when we stripped that gold to silver standard from the money, we've left the public with an inability to retain value in money they have to labor to earn. So the idea of owning a St. Gaudens or any kind of American gold or silver coins is to provide a counterbalance to the inevitable weakness in a paper dollar. So we have to think 5 years from now. If we have $100,000 in a bank today, how much in the way of goods and services will be lost in the next 5 years due to the inflation of that money? And how do we protect against that loss? It seems to me we can't stop the government from spending the money. We can't eliminate the fact we already have the $28 trillion plus in debt. We can't stop the fact that the government is now spending so much that the entire GDP now is the output is equal to the debt load. So at some point, if our government will not provide us with a gold or silver backed currency, it's up to the individual citizens to own their own physical gold and silver as a way of protecting their wealth from inflation in the future, which I see as inevitable because I just don't see Congress not spending more money in the future than it takes in. And I think this is going to be perpetual.
Because they don't really have a choice, right? They don't really have a choice unless they, I don't know, get religion and cut the budget by $3 trillion or so, whatever.
Sure.
It's not going to happen.
I mean, you know, they could stop spending money they don't take in, sure. But that would be, okay, so let's look at how that would appear, right? So first of all, you couldn't expand any government services. Forget that. You'd probably have to start cutting back on massive numbers
everything.
Of government services.
Everything.
And this is where everything the government spends money on, you know, all of the social services. And this is where we start drawing political lines, because people will start to argue what's appropriate, you know, what's correct for the government, what is morally right. Should the government say to people, okay, you know, for example, the Social Security recipients, should they argue that, look, the entire nation is so far in debt, we need you to sacrifice. And yes, you know, properly contributed as you were asked to, and well, you didn't really have a choice. We've stripped that money from your check every week, but you did what you're supposed to do. And now at the end of the line, we're going to say to you, you know, sorry, we don't have your money. And you just have to accept the fact that we're broke and you have to take less. Or the government has to reduce the number of other services that it provides to people. So politically, we start drawing this line of how do we address that? And the problem is nobody wants to be told that you're going to get less services from your government. No politician is going to go and win an election.
It's not going to do it, right?
By telling people you're going to have to sacrifice. You know, nobody wants to hear that. They all want to hear that things are going to be great in the future and that somehow we'll figure all this out. But to me, the math is starting to get unwieldy. Hmm. We've really achieved a level at which the numbers are simply so large that there just isn't any actual mechanism to unwind this volume of debt in any reasonable period of time. And I assure you that if we stopped today and didn't spend another cent from right now forward, it would still take between 10 and 20 years to try to unwind all the money that we've created just in the past 3 or 4 years to deal with this most recent crisis.
I wonder why.
We currently owe.
So before we go on to Martha, just to kind of wrap with your company, what's the main argument for what you do, numismatic coins, real gold and silver coins, which are encased and all graded and all that, as opposed to just buying a 100 ounce of silver, a bullion, what we call bullion. What's your main your main play for that, your main argument?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, I think owning gold or silver bars is better than a paper note in any way, shape, or form. However, between the two, the gold or silver coins minted by the United States government have two distinct advantages. The first one, which is important to some people, is that the bullion world is already federally regulated. And that means if you sell volume of gold bars, for example, the dealer buying them is required to take a Social Security number, file a 1099-B with Internal Revenue, provide all that private information to Internal Revenue. You have to justify your cost basis, and it has to match what's on your tax return. And they theoretically could outlaw the private ownership of bullion because it is a regulated part of the government's world. The coin market is free from all of those regulatory issues. The second thing, which I think is, to me, more important, although, again, the privacy is critical to a lot of people, is the fact that a 1933 or earlier $20 gold coin only exists in the world today in a volume of what was produced up to that point. They can never, ever go back to make more of them to meet any additional demand. And that means that the value of a $20 gold coin not only can increase because of the underlying price of gold itself going up, but also because that coin is progressively becoming harder to get and fewer people will be able to own them as the supplies diminish. So the values increase a little bit above the metal growth as time marches on because they become progressively rarer. This is why the mint condition coins of the older types already carry a higher value than merely their gold content, and why there are over 100 coins that have each achieved a price of over $1 million per coin. There are over 100 coins that have achieved $1 million price tag. It's not because they have $1 million worth of gold or silver, but they have become so rare and so valuable that it now takes 1 million Federal Reserve notes to buy them. So simply, it's a lack of supply, a fixed supply of the pre-33 gold and pre-64 silver coins that distinctively is an advantage over bullion. And again, secondly, the lack of federal regulations. Not that I ever foresee a time again in the future that the government would try to outlaw the private ownership of gold. But again, the regulatory issues can become more and more strict. There's nothing to prevent the government from doing what it wants. It owns that market. And I like free markets that don't require me to have to divulge private information. I like not being obligated by federal regulations. I like not having to ask customers for private information. And I don't want to be regulated under anti-money laundering rules and things of that nature that the government can apply to the bullion world.
I see.
While I think bullion is better than paper, I think coins are better than bullion.
Can you hear the rain? Man, we've got some. It's coming down.
It got dark.
With the tin roof, it's very loud here. I'm glad it's not drowning you out. Here's an email from Leah. It's a pretty name. Wondering what happens if there's a switch to digital currency. There's lots of talk about this lately.
Sure. You know, to me, we could talk about that at some other point with things like cryptos. But basically, the idea of, let's say, just simply digital currency, effectively nothing really would change except the way money looks. So we would still have the same situation. We'd still have a central bank producing money, except taking instead of the form of an actual paper note. And when you went to your bank to withdraw money, instead of them handing you these paper bills, instead you'd have credits in the form of electronic blips, digits added to your account, perhaps put on a card that you would then use to make your conduct of commerce. So the only thing that would change is, number one, the appearance of the way money looks. But in my opinion, also more importantly, we lose a lot of the ability to watch what's happening in the monetary system if we're not printing money anymore. In other words, if we're completely electronic and we can't go to that H4.1 release anymore and we can't count the number of dollars, then how do we know when the Federal Reserve has pushed that button on the keyboard and added more blips into the system? Where is the accountability?
Wouldn't they still have to have a balance sheet? Why would the H4.1 go? Because sure. isn't most of the currency, I mean, it's mostly digital anyway, right? 96% right now. So if they want 100%, why would they not have to put that on the balance sheet? I don't understand that.
Well, I'm not saying they wouldn't have to put it on the balance sheet. I'm just saying that the balance sheet would become so much more difficult to really look at and be careful about assessing the reality of where it is or finding the holes. Mm-hmm. When everything goes electronic, it just becomes much more difficult to keep an eye on what's happening within the economy. I think we lose an accountability issue. That becomes a big problem for me if we can't see how much money they're printing or be able to make them count the number of dollars out there somehow that we can verify. Not that anybody's going to go around counting the number of dollars in the world, but, you know, in theory, you know, we should be able to figure out how much paper exists. But if we're a completely electronic system, to me, that just becomes a little too closed. It's too closed of a market. There's just no way anymore to really keep an eye on what's happening. And I think we lose a big accountability issue that, again, maybe I'm being a bit conspiratorial or concerned about what would happen if we did that. I feel better knowing that there's still a paper dollar out there we can count.
Yeah.
And I think we would find the expansion of money would probably accelerate if it all became electronic.
Once a month we talk with Fred Deshefsky, uscoincapital.com, his company, US Coin Capital. And the show is brought to you by Fred, and we appreciate it. And his number is 878. Let's see, because you've changed 800-468-2646, right? No? Oh, no.
Well, that'll work, but 800-878-2646.
Yeah, 800-878-2646. That's your favorite number, 800-878-2646. Do you think there is anything kind of tinfoil hatty conspiratorial to this whole COVID thing, and we're running out of coins? I mean, people have been talking about that the last 2 months. You know, all the places we don't have change. And is this a conspiratorial thing to get rid of more of the coins, do you think? Or
no, I don't think so.
No.
And in reality, just to kind of make that clear, there is no shortage of current coins. It's a false concept that we're actually seeing a shortage. What we're seeing is a lack of movement.
Oh.
It's not like there aren't plenty of these things out there. They're just not being used. So everybody became concerned about potentially spreading viruses by handling coins or touching somebody when you're handling
coins. Well, see, that's what I was asking. I wonder if that meme was just a lie. No?
Yeah, I'm not buying the premise that there's any shortage of modern coins. There's no metal content in any of the modern coins. There's certainly no real shortage of them. But what there is a lack of movement. They're just simply not flowing. People still have plenty of them. We're just not seeing a lot of them being actually handled. And that's creating a short-term problem. But as soon as COVID ends, it will resolve itself. It reminds me in the 1920s, when the new Indian head gold coins were designed, they had made a $2.50 and $5 Indian head gold coin that were what they called incused. In other words, every coin you've ever seen, the details are raised off of the surface. But on these two coins, the 2.5 and 5 Indian, they punched them into the field. So the details are actually lower than the surface. And there was a fear in the 1920s that Legionnaire's disease was being spread in the crevices of the coins.
Yeah.
And people were afraid to spend the 2.5 and 5 Indians. Well, that turned out to be, you know, a false problem, but it was a rumor that spread and created the same issue. It was a lack of movement of these things for a while. They weren't rare at the time. They just simply weren't being used. And the same thing is currently happening with the modern change. It's a funny revision of an old problem. But fear does a lot to the public.
Yeah.
You know, people will react to
what Fred's talking about in the velocity. You could you can just type in velocity of money, Fred, not Fred, Fred, but Federal Reserve, St. Louis, Fred. And you could pull up the velocity of MZM money stock. And I don't know what these number means, but if you just look at, if I can move my mouse here, into the end of 2019, the number was 1.3. That's the number they give to how much money is being velocitized. Fred just moves back and forth. And today, as we speak, that is down to 0.953. So, I mean, it's still dropping. P- people are holding on to their money even more in the last 6 months, right? I guess they're just fearful of, or maybe they can't even go out because of the lack.
Well, it's a combination of things, right? You have a lack of people willing to do it for those people that are concerned. Mm-hmm. On top of that, of course, you have a much slower economy as a rule of thumb because everything is slowed down. So without people going to restaurants and spending money where they normally would spend it, if you reduce that spending, naturally you're going to get a lot less of a velocity. That certainly makes sense. But I think this is temporary.
Well, what is recently, Chairman Powell, before we go, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, he said some things in the last few weeks that were significant. I guess, was it mostly that we're not going to do much more except keep giving you more money? I mean, we're not going to raise interest rates, and he was pretty clear about that?
No, in fact, he's made two things clear. Number one, this what they call accommodative rate market environment, and by accommodative, they mean keeping interest rates low, is going to persist for quite some time. They are not intending anytime soon to start raising interest rates. And that is a big problem because in the massive amount of money that we're accelerating by putting more money into the economy, the inflation that's being created by that would require, under normal circumstances, rising interest rates to help absorb that liquidity that's being produced. But the Fed is faced with a problem. And the problem is the economy right now is struggling and it's very slow. And the fear is raising interest rates would slow the economy further. And that's the last thing the Fed wants to do. The Fed is trying to accelerate the economy, but has already lowered interest rates to about zero. So it doesn't have any room to drop interest rates from here forward to jumpstart the economy, to step on the gas pedal, so to speak. But the last thing that it wants to do is to raise rates, because again, the fear would be it might choke or slow down any kind of economic growth we're getting. So at the same time that the Fed is going to continue to print any amount of money it deems necessary, and Chairman Powell has been very clear that they will continue to pump as much capital into the economy in all these new areas as long as they deem it necessary and not worry about the consequences down the road. And they're going to do this without raising interest rates for as long as they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
That is an interesting combination that is going to end up resulting in a massive inflation of the U.S. dollar over time.
If we dare to dip our toe in the political water, I mean, because it's pretty swampy any way you look at it, but let's tie it in with the money before we go. There's quite a few people out there that are floating the idea that no matter what happens on election night, we're not going to know. I'm sure you've seen it. We're not going to know who wins for a few weeks, could be a month. Mainly the globalists, you know, the Zuckerbergs of the world, and some other people are out there really selling this idea. If this would happen,
you mean like a Bush Gore kind of?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's some forces that really, it seems to me that there's some forces that really want things to get ugly, you know, in November, regardless of how many votes are in. You know, like they're really selling. Zuckerberg is real clear. I mean, there was a whole video that we have, and oh yeah, he said this is not gonna, you know, no way. They have to count all the votes. I mean, that's the globalists who are talking about counting all the votes, which is all this mail-in stuff. I wonder if this would happen. There's no way to tell what that would have on, I guess, markets, price of gold, anything that we're kind of curious about. We wouldn't know. It could be.
Well, anytime you have uncertainty, you create volatility. And volatility is a fundamental problem that generally is addressed by entering into more and more conservative vehicles. So mm-hmm. The tendency, for example, historically, is let's say that this uncertainty of the results of an election persists for any period of time, you'll probably get a lot more volatility in the stock market, which normally would lead people to buy bonds as a quote-unquote safe haven. The problem is we have negative returning yields on bonds in the real world because the interest that they're paying is so low that when you take out the current inflation rate, the real result is actually that they're losing money.
You're losing money by buying a bond. Right.
And as people recognize that, that becomes then less and less of an option. So instead, we're finding that people are looking at gold and silver as a better method of storing wealth. So, you know, I think volatility would probably be a bigger problem with more uncertainty. You know, the clearer things are, the more defined we can be about our expectations. So if you believe that the Democratic Party is going to end up with certain results and certain programs that would benefit parts of the economy, you can plan accordingly. If you believe the Republicans are going to win and you know what their guidelines are, then you can plan accordingly. If you don't know who's going to win or who's going to end up as president and be in control, again, that leads to an awful lot of uncertainty. And that leads to speculation. But, you know, look at the stock market the past few weeks. It has been extremely volatile. That VIX volatility index that we talked about is really up there because apparently there's a lot of expectation that it's going to bounce up, it's going to bounce down. Every day you hear the news of the day, and if it's good about the economy, you know, the market rallies. But the past 4 or 5 days when economic news has not been terrific, the market is dropping rather quickly, and there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of support to it. And if the Fed stops intervening into this market and artificially propping it up by buying all those corporate bonds, well, the volatility is probably going to expand even more. And I think that's problematic for investors. I think this is really why I believe people should be diversified and, again, have a portion of their wealth in the physical gold and silver coins.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Fred, it's always fun to have you here. You look great. And so how about just in closing, when you talk to people and people call you at 800-878-2646, what kind of sense do you get from customers and inquiries, concern, bullish? What kind of things in general are you hearing when you talk to people?
Well, we talk to a really wide group of people, very diversified across the entire country, since we have customers in just about every state and all sorts of different economic strata. I think the growing concern is the lack of confidence that people have in the markets as a whole. I think because they've seen the volatility, and it just raises the issue of, you know, whether or not they feel comfortable where they are. Mm-hmm. And I think people are sort of yearning to try to get a sense of how to determine how to protect themselves going forward. So with everything the way it is, you know, we are fostering an awful lot of conspiracy theories in this kind of environment. Right. It's almost natural.
Yeah, right.
You lock people up for months at a time and give them nothing to do. Well, yeah, you know, you're going to end up with a bunch of conspiracy theories coming out of everything. So we have to dismiss a few of those as we move forward. But I guess what I'm getting from people is this general growing concern about uncertainty, about what to do to make sure that they don't make a big mistake in this economic environment and end up being in the wrong place. And my experience has taught me one thing. All the financial crises we've ever experienced in my lifetime, and then going back and historically researching all the ones that happened before I was born, The end result has always been about the same. Those people that had multiple asset classes within their investments fared well. Anybody who ended up too heavily weighted in any one market were the ones that got hurt the most. And, you know, in the 80s, it was all about mutual funds. In the late 90s and early 2000s, it was all about real estate and mortgage-backed securities. And in the current market, we're finding that a lot of people are just thinking that we've seen this trap before. Many of them have lived through it, and they don't want to experience it again. So I think there is a growing concern. And as people learn about the massive amount of money that we're printing and the massive debt the government is carrying, you know, even those people that are not experienced with this are sort of trying to get their head wrapped around, how does any government address an issue this large? How do you deal with it? So it's been interesting. But there seems to be a regaining of a thirst for knowledge, that I find a big resurgence of that.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
trying to get a good understanding of what the economy is like in real terms. And, you know, there's so much information out there, as you said. There's so many blogospheres out there. There's a lot of information to sift through to kind of come up with some sense of reality.
Some sense of reality. Well, we're all looking for that, Mr. Fred. Okay, your phone's ringing. Go back to work. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next month. Appreciate it. And your number again is 800-878-2646. I got it right.
Our website, U.S. Coin Capital, and that capital spelled like the building, C-A-P-I-T-O-L, uscoincapital.com. Come visit us. We'd be happy to educate people on exactly how this whole market works, the advantages of owning gold and silver coins, and how to do it properly.
All right, Mr. Fred, say hi to everybody. We'll talk to you real soon, sir. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com, Fred Dashevsky. We're going to kind of reboot here, regroup, and then talk to Dr. William Wong, who's coming on, and we're going to have some fun with him. He's got a lot of cool things to say, so you stay right there.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.